everyone, and welcome to Minute 61 of Season 3 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Andrea Loaf, author of a published academic article on Die Hard. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, as soon as I saw your article online, I came across it by accident, and I was like, this is someone I got to get on this show. You know, and hopefully you'll be able to instill me and the listeners with some very insightful things that either you mentioned in your article or you didn't mention in your article. I'm sure you have lots and lots to say about Die Hard. So I'm looking forward to hearing it. And hopefully everyone else is too.
Yeah.
So minute 61 begins with John placing the C4 back in Heinrich's bag and ends with Sam leaving the control room. So we ended things on Friday where John started, he basically crashed the party. You know, he started talking on the walkie-talkie. Mm-hmm. And Hans was a little shocked at the beginning that someone is actually talking. And then there was a little bit of a pause after Hans sends Carl to go find out what's going on. And there's a little bit of a pause. And then he now starts to basically stall. You know, that's what the beginning of this minute is. You know, we get a shot of John, you know, placing the explosives that when he was going through, he did an inventory last week of Heinrich's bag. So he was putting the C4 back in there. He picks up his gun and moves to a different place, a different position in the room. Mm-hmm. But while he's doing that, you know, Hans takes his radio and starts talking into it. And as I said, he's basically trying to stall for time. So he goes, "Mr. Mystery Guest, are you still there?"
I love that line.
Yes, just, it really works.
What else does he have to come? Because then we get to the point where John says, you know, what he wants to be called. And I think that is...
Right. Well, that's where we get to the end of the minute. You know, we'll get there. You know, don't jump ahead yet. I know you want to talk about that. I know you want to talk. We have a lot to talk about before we get to that line where he says what he wants to be called. Actually, the truth is, we're not even going to find out till tomorrow what he wants to be called. So, that's later in the week when he gets cut off talking to Al. Here, he actually does say who he wants to be called, and he explains why, and maybe you have some insight into that when we get to there.
He's got his catchphrase,
exactly. But at this point, you know, Hans says, "Are you still there?" And he goes, "Yeah, I'm still here, unless you want to open the front door for me." Mm-hmm. "No, I'm afraid not. But you have me at a loss. You know my name, but who are you?" "Just another American who saw too many movies as a child, another orphan of a bankrupt culture who thinks he's John Wayne, Rambo, Marshall Dillon." And then John pauses a little bit and says, "I was always kind of particular to Roy Rogers, actually. I really like those sequin shirts."
The comedy.
Yeah. And then Hans goes, "Do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy?" And we're going to stop right here because I want to actually now talk about all the different things before we get into the next line, which is obviously John McClane's most iconic line.
Yes.
Which we shall get to. We'll make everyone, you know, have to wait in anticipation to find out what it is that he's going to say. but first of all, let's break down what he did say beforehand. So Hans calls him Mr. Mystery Guest.
Yes.
So where do you think that's from? Do you have any idea where the phrase mystery guest comes from?
It sounds like it's from, like, it makes me think of Clue or like an old, like, locked room sort of mystery. And when I talk about genres in my article, mystery is not one of them, you know. So we started the detective genre, the novel that it comes before Nothing Lasts Forever, and then we go to suspense and thriller. So mystery is, I like to read them, but I don't know where does it come from.
Right. So basically the term mystery guest, I found three different uses of the term mystery guest. Okay, one of them is what we all know as a guest star. Okay, you see it on TV shows, you see it on sometimes in concerts, you know, where you have some a guest appearance by somebody, right? It's usually some sort of outside performer, could be some musician, an actor, whatever, and they are specifically using them in this role because of their celebrity. You know, usually when you look at a TV show that's going to say special guest star or whatever it is, it's someone that everyone will recognize. You know, that they're going to play a character. Like I remember, I would always watch like Law and Order episodes, and you'd see someone you recognize, and you say, "Okay, that means he's the killer." You know, it's like you think that they're and they didn't always do that. They were smart enough to throw some curveballs along the way. You know, sometimes they weren't the one who was the killer, but you know, they were definitely a suspect. You know, that's the way they would do those type of things in shows like that, right? But on TV shows, it became more popular to have guest stars where they're actors who would appear in one or maybe numerous episodes, sometimes if there's some sort of story arc or something like that. And there would be an important recurring character that even though they're not part of the main cast, they would come back. Sometimes, you know, you have it a lot in many shows where you have like grandparents or relatives or things like that, which are played by famous people. You know, you have it very often, especially nowadays in a lot of comedy shows. You know, I used to be a really big fan of NCIS, and it was the same thing also. Like the parents and grandparents of the characters were always played by someone you recognize from some from you know, the ghosts of TV past, that type of thing. Or movies past, things like that. So that's what a guest star is. And obviously they have the different types of billing and stuff like that. But we're not going to get into why everyone is billed the way they are. It's usually up to, you know, their agents and the way it's negotiated and things like that. So that's the first one. The second term of a mystery guest is also known as a mystery shopper. Have you ever heard that phrase before?
I really loved Supermarket Sweep. But mystery shopper, that's the person that, like, the grocery store itself doesn't know that they're kind of undercover. They're going in to kind
Correct.
of shop
Exactly.
and see how the shopping experience is.
Yeah, I used to love Supermarket Sweep also. I remember when it was on the, you know, they'd run and they'd automatically go get the turkeys and go get the hams and, you know, get all the expensive stuff first, you know, stuff like that. Yeah. But so a mystery shopper is sometimes known as a mystery consumer, mystery research, secret shopper, or a secret shopping and auditor. Okay, it's basically companies would send people to different markets in order for them to do research as to, you know, the quality of their sales and services, job performances, if there's regulatory compliance and things like that. I mean, it used to be for other reasons, but nowadays we see it more, you know, on TV shows that they want to show the public that they're on top of things and they want to make sure that everyone in their business is doing things the way that they should be doing them. You know, I think that's what it comes down to more so than not. But I mean, it's an interesting. I never would have thought of making this type of connection to that being a mystery guest type of thing. But it works. I mean, it's you know, I like the diverse way you can look at it because here, you know, we had the first one and then we have the second one, and now the third one that we're going to talk about is the in the TV game show What's My Line from the 50s. They would have an entire round that was known as the mystery guest round, where they would blindfold all of the contestants. They had like I think three or four contestants. They would blindfold them and they would bring someone, you know, a mystery guest in order for them to try and guess by asking questions who this person is, right? And you know, they were allowed, you know, one question at a time. Usually the guests came from somewhere in the entertainment world, sometimes the stage, screen, television, sometimes sports and things like that. Now the guests would actually try and hide their identity. You know, they would disguise their voices. But quite often, the panelists were able to figure out pretty quickly who it was. And the reason they would be able to figure it out was because they, back then, everyone knew who was in town. You know, like which celebrities were visiting. I don't remember if this was taking place in New York or LA, but they would know which celebrities are in town? You know, is there a major movie that's coming out? Or is there a play that's coming out that's about to open? Or is there, you know, a sports team that's supposed to... So this is where they would usually be able to guess in advance, you know, pretty quickly. So they would have to, like, drag it out a little bit in order to make it seem as if they couldn't guess it as quickly. You know, so, I mean, those are the three different types of things I found for the mystery guest. Okay.
Yeah.
And so continuing with the dialogue, first of all, I always love the line, an American who saw too many movies as a child, you know, I fit into that category. maybe you do too. Maybe most of our listeners do too. I don't know.
Yeah.
I have a lot of friends that are, you know, which it's funny that Gruber uses that phrase, you know, that he automatically says, okay, because again, this is the late 80s. So what he's referring to is someone who was watching a lot of TV in the 50s and 60s, not even later than that. You know, like for us nowadays, okay, I'm a child of the late 70s, early and the 80s. So for me, John McClane and anyone else, any pop culture, you know, references from the 80s, that's my childhood. You know, Back to the Future, Gremlins, Ghostbusters, you know, the list goes on and on, obviously besides Die Hard. But, you know, here he's talking about a you know, 20 years before this is taking place. So that's like a completely different era than what we're used to.
There's those old TV sets.
Yeah.
I mean, I saw most of the TV.
Exactly. I saw most of those shows because, you know, as a child of the 80s, they were all on reruns. You know, I loved watching Gilligan's Island, The Munsters. What other shows were on back then? I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched, My Three Sons. I mean, all those shows that he must be referring to here. When you're talking about comedies, he's obviously not just talking about comedies here. He's talking more about, I guess dramas or action movies or TV shows, stuff like that. Because his next line is what really gets me. And I'm assuming you have a lot to say about this, is where he goes, another orphan of a bankrupt culture who thinks he's John Wayne.
Yeah.
Okay. Rambo or Marshall Dillon. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, now, what's really funny is that, you know, he's claiming this, but McClane really is that. He is the pure product of a culture that identifies people by, you know, what you've watched and what you've, you know, the things that you've dealt with, as we just discussed earlier about, you know, about my background, you know, of getting, you know, stuff from the 70s and 80s pop culture in there, you know. And but the funny thing is because this is a Hollywood movie, it's making fun of itself from that same perspective.
Yeah, the whole I mean, it goes into the section of my article that talks about the hard body theory and what one of the folks that I cite calls a renegade individualist. Like all of these people that Hans has just named are those like same kind of male protagonist of masculinity, like peak masculinity. And this is what he's grown up on.
Right.
And I don't want to get too ahead of myself, but it comparing that to what John actually says, he like, you know, who he's partial to is very different.
Right.
And so and there's also the whole discussion of like a businessman, Hans, like in his masculinity versus where we see John McClane and, you know, he starts the movie in his, he takes off that shirt. So he's just the white tank top and pants. And then of course the tank top is like dark black brown by the end from all the sweat and the soot and blood and everything. So and he shows muscles and all of that. But there's that back and forth and there's kind of just a commentary of, who is the more masculine of the two? You know, they're pointing towards John, of course, but then there's Hans, who's this suave, like, businessman who's talking about the, like, where he got his suit, John Phillips, London, you know.
Which, if you didn't know, John Phillips is made up. It's not a real tailor. Yeah. So Arafat didn't really buy it there, you know.
I would have been interested to hear that. Oh my goodness.
Well, you can hear it.
Yes.
Just listen to the episodes that haven't aired yet. You know, you'll get there. You'll get there.
You're calling me out.
No, I said that haven't aired yet. Yeah. You're not there yet. Those episodes have not aired as we're recording, so that's fine. You're good.
That's good.
You're good. Yeah. Right. No, but I mean, yeah. look at Hans. Hans, you mentioned that he's a businessman, but he has mm-hmm. no qualms with violence. Mm-hmm. You know, for him, you know, shooting Takagi, he did it without, you know, without breaking a sweat. Mm-hmm. You know, and then there was the whole, you know, bet between Theo and Carl, whether he's going to shoot him or not, you know, because they both know who Hans is and they both, you know, they're not sure if he's really going to follow through with it. Mm-hmm. You know, but apparently he did.
Yeah. And that's going back to the novel itself. John, because we don't see as much of, like, John's not like actively like, oh yeah, I'm ready to kill all the people, but it isn't, we don't get to see into his mind as much in the film versus the novel. In the novel, Joe Leland, it's all very introspective inside. Like, we get lots of thoughts from him. And so he does have those troubles. And so there is, it's more of a bigger picture of who he is as a man versus John, which a great character, but also maybe a little bit of a caricature of masculinity in terms of, you know, he's big and strong and he saves the day, kind of like all of the cowboys that he had idolized and that Han talks about.
Right. But I mean, that's obviously one of the big differences between a movie and, you know, the novel. Any novel, mm-hmm. you're able to get the character's thoughts. You know, it's done in movies. Sometimes you get a voiceover from the character, mm-hmm. but you wouldn't get voiceovers like this saying, oh, I can't believe I just killed that guy or something like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's something that they want you to feel the empathy that the character is, mm-hmm. is having by, mm-hmm. by his reactions and by how he's acting at those particular points throughout the course of the story. You know, but we're not going to get into McClane's head and hear him say that. You know, I mean, that's always why I like to see the way that they adapt, you know, the way that they adapt novels to the screen and mm-hmm. find a way to still give over the same ideas, you know, via dialogue mm-hmm. as opposed to via thoughts.
Yeah.
You know, which,
and it's interesting.
Which some movies are better at it than others.
Yeah, this one's very much a product of the Reagan era.
Yeah.
Versus, I think, Nothing Lasts Forever came out in 78. Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot more that Nothing Lasts Forever is coming kind of on the heels of Patty Hearst kidnapping. And so there's a lot more of the terrorists, the actual, it's been in the news. It's been in people's minds. You know, people could be political terrorists and taking people hostage. And late 80s were kind of more separated from that. So it's more focused on him. And there is that idea that Hans is doing this for political reasons, but John doesn't know that yet.
No, it takes a long time for John to find that out.
Yeah.
You know, but we already know it. You know, we've already found this out along the way. But so I like the way that you know, he mentions three different actors or three mm-hmm. different characters, I guess you can even say. Because John Wayne is partially a character, not just an actor. Mm-hmm. You know, he mentions John Wayne, Rambo, and Marshall Dillon, and each of them mm-hmm. are from different eras.
Yeah.
You know, they don't really, I mean, obviously John Wayne's era spanned from the 1920s all the way to the 70s. So, mm-hmm. you know, he does overlap with Marshall Dillon a little bit. He doesn't overlap with, well, he actually does overlap with Rambo if you're thinking about from the novel. Not from the movie. Okay, so let's go through them one by one. What do you know about John Wayne?
John Wayne, well, he I'm pretty sure he was born here in Iowa where I live.
Yes, he
so
was.
I think, yeah, so got that to...
He was born in Winterset, Iowa. Do you know where that is?
Yeah, that's like 1 hour and 45 minutes, 2 hours from where I live.
No, so, that's not far at all.
No, not at all.
Just a hop, skip, and a jump away.
Yeah, so, and I think he just had that bravado of the cowboy. Like, that's, I think, I feel like John Wayne is one of the most famous of the American Western cowboys.
Well, he also played a lot of times soldiers. You know, was around World War II, he was in a lot of movies where he played, you know, either a commander or most of the time he was a commander. He was some sort of, you know, he was in a command position, whether he was a sergeant or whether he was an actual officer, something like that. But, you know, he was in a lot of those movies too. But it's the same, it's the same idea. You know, it still comes from the same idea of the machoism, you know, that you can see him either as a cowboy or as a soldier. You know, do you know what John Wayne's real name was?
Oh, isn't it Marion?
Yes, his name was Marion Robert Morrison. Okay, he was born on the 26th of May, 1907, and he passed away on the 11th of June, 1979. Okay, do you know his nickname?
No, I can't think of that.
He was known as the Duke.
Oh, okay.
And do you know why he was called the Duke? He was...
Man, I don't know.
When he was a kid... He grew up in Glendale, California, and he would run by the fire station, and he would always be called Little Duke by the firemen there, because he had this dog, an Airedale Terrier, that would always go with him, and they would call him Little Duke, and the dog was known as Big Duke. And the fact that he didn't really like the fact that his name was Marion, he decided to adopt the name Duke, and that's when people started calling him Duke. Yeah, he was in 179 movies and TV shows.
I think of the when I think of the name Duke, I think of, you know, the title, the royal title.
Well, I think that eventually, you know, he took on that persona also, because he was seen as Hollywood royalty. Despite his political views, he's very much different. He's very different from most when you think of people in Hollywood, you think of liberals. He was the farthest from being a liberal as possible. But we don't get into politics here, so we're not talking about that. I'm just mentioning that fact, you know, along the way.
Fair.
Yeah. So he was in 179 movies and TV productions throughout his almost 50 plus year career. He was also among the top box office draws for more than 3 decades.
I can see that.
Yeah. In 1999, he was selected by the American Film Institute as the greatest male star of classic American cinema.
There you go.
He's definitely known for that. Have you ever seen the movie The Dirty Dozen?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so he was actually offered the role of Major Reisman, and he accepted it, and then he had to back out because he wanted to do the movie The Green Berets instead. He also wanted the role of Dirty Harry before they cast Clint Eastwood, but because he was 63 at the time, they didn't want to give it to him. So he has a few Dirty Harry doppelganger films that came out in the beginning of the 70s. You know, I'm sure, you know, friend of the show, Jay Bam, who did, you know, the Dirty Harry Minute. I'm sure he knows all about that. So yeah. Shout out to you, John. And what else? He was supposed to, Mel Brooks wanted him to play the Waco kid in Blazing Saddles.
Wow.
But he said that it was he preferred to do things that are more family friendly, and but for his image, but he told Mel Brooks that he'll still be the first in line to see the movie because he thought it was really funny. So there, another shout out to you know, friends of the show, Alan and Walt from The Wild Ride, who did Blazing Saddles Minute by Minute. So yeah, those are some fun, interesting tidbits about John Wayne. So then we get into Rambo. Okay, now first of all, I found it really, really interesting the fact that, you know, he mentions that Rambo is mentioned here, because, you know, if you're talking about a culture and or bankrupt culture and everything, so McClane easily, you know, doesn't want to associate himself with Rambo. You know, he wants to distance himself as much as possible from the action hero, because there's too many negative associations of the action hero. You know, I mean, we're about to get to the point where he actually says who he wants to be. We mentioned it before about that he wants to be Roy Rogers, or that he can identify more with Roy Rogers. So Roy Rogers, I mean, we'll get there in a second, but I know you have a lot to say about that. but there are less negative associations of action hero as Roy Rogers than there is as Rambo, you know? So what do you know about Rambo?
Well, that particular action hero, that's mostly like out in the woods and in like the mountains, right?
In the first one.
Okay. And I think it's politically motivated too, isn't it? It's like kind of a
he's a misunderstood Vietnam vet. He just wants to live on his own in his quiet, but people don't let him.
Yeah. Right. I don't know what I'm thinking of then. I thought there was something, never mind. but it's that same sort of one man versus many, or everyone else, or this group of people. So it's a similar situation. So I could see why Hans would say that.
Right. That's true. No, but Hans doesn't yet know the whole idea, but you know, but so Rambo's full name is John James Rambo. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he first appeared in the novel First Blood in 1972, which was written by David Morrell. And then obviously later on, he became more popular because of the movie franchise starring Sylvester Stallone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you know that first of all, the term Rambo has now become part of the dictionary?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So the term Rambo is used commonly to describe a lone wolf who is reckless, disregards orders, uses violence to solve his problems, enters dangerous situations alone, and is exceptionally tough, callous, raw, and aggressive. Would you term John that way also? You know, McClane?
I feel like he's close, but I wouldn't say right on with that, because I feel like there is recklessness in some of his actions, but at the same time, he's a little more calculated on what the risks are that he can take, which, you know, is a call ahead to, you know, something later in the film. But I think the whole idea of like running away instead of, you know, he could be caught right there when they come in and they're hauling all the other people out of the rooms, but he instead like formulates this last minute plan to run away and get, and just kind of like fortify his position, think about what he's going to do. I would say that he's not quite like Rambo, but it's an understandable comparison.
Yeah. Okay. I would agree with you on that. So the term, the word Rambo can be used as a noun, an adjective, or a verb. Okay. Sometimes people can refer to it as an adjective. Someone can be Rambo-esque, Ramboid, or Ramboism, right? According to like different positions. Have you ever heard the term Rambo lawyer?
No.
It's the term for a lawyer who habitually engages in all manners of adversarial excess, including personal attacks on other lawyers, hostility, boorish and insulting behavior, rudeness, and obstructionist conduct with a take no prisoners attitude. Okay, the they once asked David Morrell where he got the idea of the term Rambo to use him as the last name, and he said that he once came across a type of apple in Pennsylvania known as Rambo apples.
Wow.
Which were named after a man named Peter Gunnarsson Rambo, who came from Sweden to America in the 1640s. And therefore the name, you know, became it's a popular last name, but he liked the idea of you know, he just heard the name Rambo apples and he's like, wow, that's a great idea for you know, for a character. It's always apples amazing where people get their ideas from.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Comparing apples to oranges, right?
Yeah, apples to machine guns.
Comparing apples to machine guns, apples to McLean's, you know. Yeah. Seriously. Okay, so now we're on the final one. Marshall Dillon.
Marshall Dillon.
What do you know about that?
This one I'm less familiar with because part of me thinks, okay, well, when I hear Marshall, okay, like I can think of the Old West and someone who's going to catch all the people who have bounties on their heads or make sure, you know, they're not quite the sheriff, but they're the one.
That's a bounty hunter.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
So, but yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay. So Marshall Dillon was a character. He was the Marshal of Dodge City, Kansas. Okay. His name was Matt Dillon. He was on the radio and television versions of Gunsmoke.
Okay.
He is a character that was created by the writer John Meston. And he was for 9 years on radio and 20 years on TV. Now, what's very interesting about this character is the number of things that he went through. So there in 2013, the president of the Arizona Historical Society and the vice president of the Wild West History Association, he did a little bit of research. His name was Marshall Trimble, right? Marshall with two L's, not as in,
yeah,
you know, not Sheriff, yeah, Trimble. Marshall Trimble was his first name.
Yeah.
So he did a little bit of research about Matt Dillon, and he found out that he was shot at least 56 different times throughout the course of the show. He was knocked unconscious 29 times. Stabbed 3 times and poisoned just once. Only one time was poisoned throughout all those episodes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot to happen to someone.
Yes. Yeah. Now, as they're talking, you know, throughout this conversation between Hans and John, so John is walking cautiously throughout the conference room. You know, there's one part where there's one place where he takes his gun and he opens it, and like he pushes like a wooden partition aside with the barrel of the gun, which is an interesting thing to do, because if you want to always have, if you want to be, you know, on guard, you want to make sure their gun is always in front of you. And if you're pushing something aside, especially since he puts it within the square, he doesn't push it on the outside. You know, it stays within the square of that partition. So it was pretty funny the way that he does that, you know, and then he, you know, walks around throughout the floor, you know, looking around, and then he ends up looking towards the area where the elevators are, right? Seeing what's going on. I think he knows that Hans is just basically stalling here, you know, but he's playing with him. Because he's still moving around. He's not standing in the same spot. You know, he's still moving along throughout the entire thing. Okay. And then we get to the point where he mentions the fact that he says, I was kind of partial to Roy Rogers, actually. I really like those sequin shirts.
Yes. Which contrasts with the three previously named.
Yes.
You know, the sequin shirts, his choice of cowboy to emulate is the most unrealistic, because they're all movie cowboys, but he's got the sequin shirts, and he picks like a more effeminate cowboy almost. So it kind of goes against just slightly undercutting that hard body masculinity and you know, the typical Reagan era masculinity that Hans seems to try to be putting onto him, but he goes with Roy Rogers instead, which is another one of his little like one-liners, the comedy of the movie.
Do you think John really likes Roy Rogers, or he's playing with Hans?
I mean, I think it's a good thing to play with Hans, because he could be, then he's underestimating him. Like, why choose Roy Rogers, the guy that has all of those sequins, the shininess of the shirt? But I mean,
does he expect Hans to know?
He also wants to have his catchphrase, the yippee-ki-yay. He wants to be able to say that.
Could be also. But do you think he expects Hans to know who Roy Rogers was?
You know, I don't know, because I mean, if Hans knows all those other cowboys, maybe he also knows Roy Rogers, because it's not, Roy Rogers isn't exactly an unknown, you know. But I mean, later on he catches him in saying the wrong person that he was dancing with, but
yeah.
Gary Cooper.
Yeah.
But I think he would, I don't think he would expect Hans not to know him. You know, I don't think he's picking Roy Rogers because that's the unknown that makes, therefore, him, John, unknown.
Right. Okay. All right. That's fair. So what do you know about Roy Rogers?
Well, the sequin shirts, I'm a twin. So I grew up watching Mary-Kate and Ashley movies, and they have To Grandmother's House We Go. I'm really digging into the deep dives here, but that whole movie is that the twins hitch a ride with the UPS guy, who I think is his name also Roy. I don't remember. It might also be, but that guy likes to listen to Roy Rogers. And so I heard those songs probably for the first time in that movie.
Oh, wow.
And they would also like, they would, like, there were these scenes where they'd put black and white and it would be the UPS guy imagining himself as Roy Rogers and like saving everyone. So it's, I know of the black and white, and I know some of the songs, although I can't think of the lyrics right now.
Right. Okay. Because no, that's fine. That, you don't, no need to sing.
Reference.
No need to sing. So do you know what Roy Rogers' real name was?
Oh, that one I don't know.
So his name was, he was born Leonard Franklin Sly. S-L-Y-E. Oh. He was born November 5th, 1911, and passed away on July 6th, 1998. Okay. He appeared in over 100 movies and radio and TV episodes of his own show called The Roy Rogers Show. He was famously married to Dale Evans, who was also a famous or she was in a lot of his movies as his wife. His horse was named Trigger, who was his faithful horse Trigger, and he had a German shepherd called Bullet. And he ended up he lent his name to the franchise chain, a food franchise of Roy Rogers Restaurants.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. He is actually, he has three, he, on the same day, he got 3 stars on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
Wow.
Okay. All of them on Vine Street, but a few blocks away. He got one, this all happened on February 8th, 1960. He got his star for movies at 1752 Vine Street, his star for TV on 1620 Vine Street, and his star for radio at 1733 Vine Street. Okay. He also was twice elected to the Country Music Hall of Fame. He's the only person who has been elected there twice. Once as part of the group that he used to play with, the Sons of the Pioneers, and then again as a soloist. So
wow.
That's also quite interesting to know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, John takes a look and sees that, you know, it's possible that he hears the elevator moving, because then a second later we hear the beep of the elevator. You know, and because, you know, as we mentioned earlier, Han says to him, do you really think you have a chance against us, Mr. Cowboy? And then we hear like the elevator bell ding, and then he goes, yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker. You know, this is the first time that he says it in the movie or in the franchise.
Yes.
And, you know, he says it like somewhat silently, and I like the way that he does it. He does it like in a soft voice, mm-hmm. I guess you can say. But I love the way that it's as if it's his, you know, his call sign, the way that he's just ending the conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just the...
Yeah. And it plays on the yodel of Roy Rogers, yes. too, which is mm-hmm. It's such a great line. Every time I watch the movie, I think I like, I'm waiting. I'm like, is it coming? It's coming. It's coming. And then he says it. And I sometimes say it with him along. It's my favorite part.
Okay.
I mean, I'm sure that I share that with some other people as well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
When they think this movie, they think that one.
That's right.
I mean, we're saying yippee-ki-yay at the end of every episode.
That's right. That is correct. But
by the way, I remembered the song for Roy Rogers. It was Don't Fence Me In.
Oh, okay. I know Don't Fence Me In. Yes. Yeah. I'm trying to remember where I know it from. I know it from some movie where it was playing in the background or something like that, or maybe it was a TV show. It was not from Mary-Kate and...
No, To Grandmother's House We Go is the name of
them. It definitely doesn't come from there because... I didn't watch those shows. So. No. I watched Full House.
Niche audience.
Yeah, I watched Full House, but I didn't go beyond that. You know, that was enough for me. But I'm actually now very curious where Don't Fence Me In, where I would have heard it from. Actually, it's Bing Crosby who sung Don't Fence Me In.
Oh. Well,
wait, Cole Porter and Gene Autry. And Willie Nelson and Riders in the Sky, maybe.
Oh, shoot. Well, I don't know then. It might have been, I might have a completely different association. And here I thought it was Roy Rogers the entire time.
No, it's possible he also sung it. You know, there are.
Maybe, yeah.
There are a lot of people who sing it. Yes, okay. Mm-hmm. Roy Rogers, there
That's
you go.
Okay.
Roy Rogers sung it in the movie.
Validated.
In the 1944 movie, Hollywood Canteen.
Okay.
Yeah, and then he did a song the following year, movie the following year called "Don't Fence Me In" with the Elevens.
All right.
And so he sung there that also. Yeah, and then there's a Bing Crosby version. There's a Frank Sinatra version. Okay, there are looking on Wikipedia. There's at least like 20 or 25 different versions of it. I'm not going to go into all of them.
Popular song.
No. I can't remember. Again, I still can't remember what Bob Hope did it on the Muppet Show.
No.
I'm looking at all the different references where it was, and I don't see something that really jumps out at me as that would be what would reminded me of the of that. So no, I don't know. I don't know exactly where I would have. Heard that from originally. So where do you think that...
I think it fits John, though.
Yes, that is true. So where do you think the term yippee-ki-yay comes from?
Oh, gosh. So, I mean, when I'm just looking at it, because I've pulled up the part of my article that talks about it as a parody, but then... like, you know, a combination of Western bravado and modern profanity. But yippee-ki-yay itself, I mean, the yodel, perhaps. But when I look at K-A-I in the middle, I mean, that seems Japanese. Like, but I don't know.
No, but first of all, just so you know, it's written numerous ways.
Yeah, so I have it
it's
one
not,
way.
Right, that's not, and, you know, it's not a set way that it is. So it's an old American cowboy expression, similar to yippee mm-hmm. or yeehaw, or whoopee, yeah. And it's an expression. These are all expressions of extreme joy or excitement.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes Yahoo could also be used in a similar vein. Okay, but if you're trying to find so the word yip. Is part of there's the phrase yippee, or the term yippie, which originated in the 15th century, and it meant to cheep as a young bird. You know, to like make a little bit of a sound from it. To emit a high-pitched bark is it changed to that in 1907. And then it began to – everyone – and it gained the figurative meaning to shout or to complain. Okay. Now, it's also similar to – some people say that it comes from the term yelp. Okay.
Yeah.
So yelp is boasting is a way of boasting speaking. A yawp is an even older form of that, you know, from the 14th century, in which most people nowadays associated with the barbaric yawp from the 19th century.
Yes.
Where's that from? Do you know?
Okay. Oh my gosh. Because I.
Who needs to let out the barbaric.
Right?
Yes, it is. Who needs to let out the barbaric yawp?
I mean, I have to do that. But that I,
in what movie? In
I
what
sound movie? My barbaric yawp from. Oh gosh. What's the rest of it? But that's one of those popular scenes also from Dead Poets
that
Society.
That is correct. Dead Poets Society.
With Robin Williams and the kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I always think of it. I always think of it in the first person I, but I don't know if there's actually a different subject.
Right. No. So I was referring to yawp from Dead Poets Society. Then yip. Okay. Is, the earliest known use of that, which is an exclamation of delight, was in 1920 in Sinclair Lewis's novel Main Street, where one of the teachers screams out "Yippee!" and then if you look at a yippee, the yippee that I said before was Y-I-P-P-E-E, but Y-I-P-P-I-E is a member of political radical hippies, mostly from the late 60s, which it stood for the Youth International Party. And it was, you know, they were named after the hippies. So they had the yippies and the hippies.
Huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
That may make sense then.
So in the 1930s, Bing Crosby had a song called I'm an Old Cowhand, where in the middle of the song, he says, yippie ya yo kaya.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah.
How did he figure that out?
No. I guess John really was looking, really did see all these separate shows when he was a kid. You know, he might have been making fun of Hans, but he did know the reference. So in this article that I was reading, it's really funny. It says in the end, do cowboys really say this? We're guessing probably not, unless, of course, they're single-handedly and shoelessly defeating a gang of bank robbers on Christmas Eve.
And shoelessly. Yes. But that... a lot of that, I mean, it's like a onomatopoeia of like just yelling, you know, it doesn't have to necessarily mean anything when you say it, it's the feeling of it. So that makes sense. Track.
Yeah. But what's great is that, you know, it's held up for 34 years, you know, just putting those two phrases together, yippee-ki-yay and motherfucker together has created an iconic line. You know, that is quoted quite often.
Yep.
Not just in Die Hard movies. You know.
Yeah.
So before.
Because everyone's calling back now.
That's right. So if you, before we get into the, in this minute, we go to another scene. Before we get into that other scene, is there anything else you want to say about this particular back and forth between Hans and John?
No, nothing's coming to mind right now. So. I will call it close.
Okay, so the last thing I wanted to say was is that right after John gives his catchphrase, so we get a shot of Hans looking strangely at his radio, contemplating what was just said. You know, he doesn't completely get it, but they do it really well. And then the scene changes, and we're back in the newsroom. You know, we saw last week about the newsroom where where Thornburg hears the call over the radio.
Yeah.
And, you know, we have a shot of Thornburg who says, I can get a jump on everybody if I get a remote. And then we hear the newscaster, Harvey, in the background say, I don't have the new pages. Where's the Gladden report?
Where are the new pages?
Where's the Gladden report? And then the guy who Thornburg is walking next to says, "Harvey, keep your pants on, will ya?" Thornburg turns to him and says, "Sam, look, I'm begging you." And Sam responds, "Simon's at a remote thing with that Santa sing-along." And that's pretty much how the minute ends. Now, we've already met Thornburg, so we already know who he is. Do you know who the guy is who plays Sam, the station manager?
No, I don't.
Okay, so he's a famous comedian who did a lot of stand-up at the time, named Mark Goldstein, who was born on June 19th, 1952, and he passed away on...
oh, my gosh.
He passed away on the 29th of September, 2008. Okay, he only...
June 19th is my birthday.
Oh, wow. There you go. Very cool. And so he only has 7 movie credits. He was in, he's in this movie. He's in the movie Punchline with Sally Field and Tom Hanks. There's a small little role as Mark, you know, which in that movie they had a lot of comedians who had small little roles giving comedy, giving little comedy bits. And he was also in the movie The Adventures of Fort Fairlane, which was also, which was directed by Rennie Harland, who directs Die Hard 2, right? And he there was just known as a club guy, right? He has 2 TV credits, including NYPD Blue. Now, usually I don't go into information about the particular person or whatever, but I found something so interesting about him. When he passed away in 2008, and I actually found his obituary. And it's a typical... comedian obituary that I wouldn't be surprised if he wrote it beforehand. Okay. So I'm just, it's just a few lines. I'm just going to quickly read it. It's, and I found this on the LA Times website from October 5th, 2008. Okay. Cause he passed away on September 29th, just a week beforehand. So it says Goldstein Mark 56, writer, actor, comic, self-proclaimed loser in Miami of diabetes related complications. Everyone called Mark the funniest person they knew. Mark finally took the one-way train ride to Loserland. With love and affection, the I Lent Goldstein $20 Club. Fred Hunter Funeral Home, Hollywood, California. Now, that sounds really mean.
Yeah.
Now, then I continued, and I was reading some of the comments that were written on the LA Times by friends of his.
Oh.
Now, I found like 20 of them. I'm only going to read 3 of them because they were just very funny.
Okay.
One of them is from a comedian named Bruce Smirnoff. He goes, "Mark, say hi to Frank for me. We'll all come see you sooner or later. Stay negative." Then there's another one from Peter Fogel, which says, "Mark was one of the funniest and angriest guys I know. The angrier he got, the funnier he got. He had a good heart. He was just misunderstood, or so he thought he was." And then the final one that I wanted to mention was from Diane Nichols. "Mark always had the look of thunder in his eyes, like the guy who runs to the gate just in time to see his plane take off. The audience often seemed scared and missed those hilarious premises and punchlines. Then you'd hear the loud whooping laugh from Andy Huggins and the other guys in the comics corner all thinking, 'Great freaking line.' He had a shy smile and laugh that came with a tilted head. Rare but worth the wait. Godspeed, Mark. Don't forget to get off at the white light." So I just find it really funny that these are things that people are writing in an obituary or a response to an obituary. You know, you think, they're comedians. So I you take it all with a grain of salt. I assume that none of this was meant to be insulting, and they did a nice job of that. And that's pretty much how we're going to end this minute, you know. But once again, I actually want to mention one other thing. Sorry. So he mentions mentions that what's the name of the other guy? Simon is at a remote thing with Santa with that Santa sing along. So I mean I've mentioned this numerous times over the course of this podcast, and I'm sure I'm going to mention it in the future also. But nobody seems to be taking this hostage takeover very seriously. You know, the fact that the news producer is saying, "Oh, there's a guy doing a Santa sing-along. I'm going to send him over to take care of, this hostage crisis at the Nakatomi building." You know, like we talked about with the police dispatchers and even what they were told Powell, what they didn't tell Powell when he was on his way, to go check out Nakatomi and stuff like that. It's just something sounds off here. You think that there should be more credit. You know, I mean, maybe it's because we live in a post 9/11 world. But I mean, I was living in 1988 also, and I would think that if someone heard the word terrorist threat on a building, they wouldn't just scoff it off the way that everyone seems to be doing it here. You know, because
every time, I mean, this is earlier in the film, but when he first makes his call to her, and she's or to the
he gets 911
TV radio, right. And he's doing that, the 911 call, and she's, you'll have to make a call on your telephone. She just goes through this, and he's just like,
"What? Hang on, I'm ordering
a pizza." Like,
that's right.
Like, when you just like, I have that thought every time I see that, because it's like, yeah, like, of course he knows where he's called. Like, that's his only line. Like, why would he just do that for no reason?
Correct.
And I guess maybe crank calls are too much in that time, and like, oh, it's, you know, they don't think it could be anything because it's just someone having fun on Christmas Eve. Also, who does that on Christmas Eve?
Right. That's true also. I don't know. Just, it's very strange. This is just another example, you know, where someone is not taking it seriously, because he's going to send the same guy who they sent to do a recording of a Santa sing-along over to Nakatomi.
Yeah. Two completely different subjects.
Yeah. I mean, later on we find out who Thornburg really is, but you at least, at this point, you can give him credit for noticing that there really is a news story here, and that it's something that needs to be taken care of. You know, again, he's thinking only of himself, but you know, the idea that he's still trying to get that information out is pretty interesting. So, I also love the walk and talk style between Dick and Sam as they're walking through, you know, they're walking through numerous rooms of the station, you know, as they're talking and stuff like that. You know, this was you know, pre West Wing, you know, they have the walk and talk. Right. Okay. So that's pretty much all I have to say about this minute before we get into the script itself. There are a few slight discrepancies in the script, not very different. McLean basically responds when Hans says to him, "Are you still there?" So McLean responds, "I wouldn't think of leaving, Hans, unless you want to open the front door." So they add in that other phrase. I don't think it's really needed. When he's talking about Roy Rogers, he says, "Actually, I was always partial to Roy Rogers," as opposed to I was always kind of partial. Just the extra word "actually," which also isn't needed there. But in the script, it doesn't say yippee-ki-yay. It says yippee-yay.
Oh, I wonder if that was then like an improvisation.
I have no idea. We'll never know.
On Bruce's part. Yeah.
We shall never know.
Or just got it wrong and they just went with it.
Exactly.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yep. All right. So every Monday we have a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guests will give us their top five Die Hard doppelganger films. So what have you got for us, Andrea? Why don't you start with number five and work your way back up?
Yeah, I'll start with number five and go up to one. So after hearing what some of the other people had done and seeing the example, so like, of course I love Speed, but I think I wanted to go a little deeper and try to find some unique examples. So we'll see if anyone else has mentioned these or not, but I'm going to start at number five, Deja Vu, which I like to say is Back to the Future meets Die Hard. So that's with Denzel Washington and going back all through. It's a fun movie, and I just remember seeing it. And
I just rewatched it like a month ago. I really enjoy it too. Yeah. The science is off, but it's good.
Of course. Number four, The Fifth Element. Ooh. Also Bruce Willis minding his own business, then drawn into a terrorist plot, but this time with aliens and a mysterious woman.
Yeah.
So that's a good one. Number three, actually a recent film that I found. I was looking through lists that other people had put together, and there's one on Screen Rant that had the 2020 film Becky. And so I watched that.
Interesting.
The other night
to
see, like, if I wanted to put it on this list, Lulu Wilson, one teenager, Lulu Wilson, against a group of neo-Nazi prison escapees led by Kevin James.
Yes. I saw that and I could not believe that that was Kevin James.
And that was, it was good. Like they had walkie talkies in it too. So, you know, you get the same sort of vibe.
Yeah.
She of Die Hard. I really liked it.
Yeah.
Like it was a lot more,
violent, graphic, yeah.
violent and tired, but still great. And, you know, a different take on the whole genre. Cause you know, a female role and a teenager at that.
Yeah.
So that was gonna be number three. My number two is The Fugitive, One Man Against the Government Marshals, with Harrison Ford. And I always loved that one. Whenever it was on TV growing up, I always just really enjoyed watching that one. And then another, I mean, I guess it's not as recent as Becky, but still within the past, I think it's within the past decade, still Taken.
Yeah. With no, it's a little more. Taken came out in 2008. 2008. So yeah,
oh, man.
But that's fine.
All right.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Those are some great choices.
Yeah. Definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah. All right.
And so top five.
All right. Great. Thank you very much for that. So if anyone wants to get in touch with Andrea, so just get in touch with me and, you know, I'll pass on anything that you may have because, you know, she's not a normal podcaster, so she doesn't have her own site. But so anyone who wants to get in touch with her, feel free to get in touch with me. Getting in touch with me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter, find me on Facebook, and you can find me on my website, which is movierobminute.com. So, Andrew, you feel like coming back again tomorrow? Yeah, you have fun today?
Yeah, it was a great time.
All right, excellent.
My first podcast.
There you go. All right, so until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.